Hello, everyone, and welcome to Film Class Zeros. It's a movie podcast by two dudes who have tons to say about the movies they love. Good ones, bad ones, and everything in between. I'm Alex, and this is Rich, so let's dive in.
All right, man. Thanks for tuning in. Today, we're going to talk about 1992's Sister Act.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the natural progression. You talk about Mortal Kombat, and then you go right into Sister Act. It was inevitable, really.
How do you feel about Sister Act?
So I thought it was an interesting pick, in particular of like what we're doing. We're just talking about, you know, a lot of it is movies that we love. And then there are things about, there are movies that we don't necessarily love, but there is like something about them that has struck a chord with either one of us, or at least has made itself sort of important or resonate with people that we still get references to it today.
Okay.
You know, it may not be like someone loves Sister Act, but if you mention something from Sister Act, they're going to know exactly what you're talking about.
So it becomes it's like almost like a gestalt kind of thing where it becomes part of something and people may not necessarily have seen it and people still reference something that they haven't seen. Almost like the this movie reminds me of the line from Hamlet, "Get thee to a nunnery." Which has been used ad nauseum since pretty much like the creation of film, but that is a line from Hamlet.
Right.
You know, so people will see a nun and say, "Hey, Sister Act," or some like weird nonsense like that, you know?
Well, they'll make the correlation. They'll see a nun, and then of all the things that we have like nun representation, I guess, in popular culture, you know, or at least characters of nuns, Sister Act is really up there. You know, if you see someone like in The Habit, you know, if you don't think immediately of like nuns being actual nuns and being part of a religious order, and then your head goes immediately to movies, it's like, or you know, pop culture, it's Sister Act, you know?
Absolutely. The one thing I want, okay, we're about the same age, right?
Yeah.
So this movie came out in 1992. I remember renting it when I was 11,
right?
I think 10 or 11, right? I remember renting it with my family and really laughing my butt off. And that's it. I think I saw the movie maybe like once or twice when we got it from the rental place, brought it back. And this is the first time I've seen this movie since 1992. It's 2020 right now.
Yep.
How about you?
Yeah, for me, it's 2020.
You're in the so as long as we're on the same page with the same year.
Well, the so you remember when you saw this movie? I don't remember that at all.
Okay.
I don't remember renting it. I certainly don't remember going to the theaters to see it. I just remember having seen it or it being on TV. So I can't pinpoint the moment of like when I went to see it, but you know, and it's one of those movies that sort of like lived on like the weird like back burner of my brain as far as like references and stuff like that.
Sure.
You know, there, and you know, like you just remember like small things, like, you know, when you go throughout your day, and I'm sure you do this. I certainly do this, where in moments where you're by yourself or with someone like you're super comfortable with, you just sort of make a reference to something because it just happens to correlate, and it's not even like a conscious thought, or like, you know, this movie is like that, you know, especially when it comes to, you know, going out to, you know, going to church or those that choir singing. Like it's more, I feel like I think about this movie more when choirs come up than when nuns come up.
Okay.
Or the church comes up, you know.
That's a very interesting point of view, and I agree with that, because honestly, like, the movies, if I watch this now, is like I'm pushing 40, we're both kind of pushing 40, and it's funny, it's fun to be two dudes pushing 40 watching Sister Act and talking about it on a podcast. But my point is, the movie is okay.
Yeah,
it's fine, the jokes don't really hold up, but I agree with you in the respect that like this movie somehow has wedged itself into our modern lexicon of references, right? Even if you saw the movie once, or even know what the, even if you know what the movie's about and have never seen it, you'll get the reference or make the reference.
Sure.
Right. Whoopi Goldberg's character witnessed a murder, and she had to go into hiding in a convent until the trial. That's it. That's the premise. That's really it. And while she's in the convent, she takes over their music program, and there you have the movie, Sister Act, because she's acting like a sister.
Right.
And then she puts on an act with the sisters.
Sure.
That's it.
Yeah, it works in so many layers. So many layers to it. It's that. That's, you're getting to the heart of it, where the movie is basically an example of a really good example of like a 90s comedy where you come up with this wacky premise and then you sort of like retroactively build the story towards it. Because now, like, you know, like the elevator pitch was funny lounge singer joins a convent, so it's like this fish out of water thing,
right?
And convents are like sad and dour and everyone's serious, but like this is going to be someone who's like from a different world and they're going to jazz things up and it's going to change everything. Mm-hmm. So you start retroactively working back like how you get someone in from there into the convent. Mm-hmm. Which the movie does, like you were mentioning, it spends like almost an hour, not an hour, but it must have been like, it felt like an hour, 53 probably.
Minutes.
Does it really?
It's about 53 minutes to get to the point.
Oh wow.
Yeah, so let's dissect this just a little bit.
Okay.
The movie starts with like an interesting flashback to who we assume is a young Whoopi Goldberg in Catholic school,
right?
She's the quote-unquote troublemaker. And, you know, like you already know, you're inferring she's got a history with nuns, a bad history, right? They hate her for some reason. Okay. Cut to her being a lounge singer in Vegas. She's not singing, by the way. I don't know if you noticed that.
Yeah. There's a couple of things where I was watching with my girlfriend. She's like, is that Whoopi Goldberg singing? It's like, I think that's her singing. I don't think that's her singing like right now. I'm sure it was like dubbed over. You know, when like they recorded the song later and, you know.
I don't think it's her at all.
I think it's her, but I haven't checked. The only reason why I think it's her is because in my research, it says like who was like this singer was the music voice for this actress.
Okay.
Sort of inferring that like this actress was not the one singing. And they didn't do that with Whoopi Goldberg, at least from what I saw. It wasn't like this is Whoopi Goldberg, but like as sung by... You know, a professional singer.
The other interesting choice is that she's a lounge singer, not in Vegas, but in Reno.
Right.
Which is fascinating to me. I've only been to Vegas, and I went once, and we both agree. I know you've been. We both agree. Not a big fan of Vegas. Tell me why.
I like how you say, I know you've been. Like,
yeah. I'm reading the notes. That's why.
Sure. Well, I've been to Vegas.
Unless you're lying about this.
Yeah, right? This is. I just want to talk about Vegas. I'm trying to get a trip out of Vegas out of this. Mm-hmm. But I've been to Vegas a handful of times. Every time I've gone has been for some work-related thing. I've never gone to Vegas for fun.
Okay.
And it's mostly due to just like, I mean, that's just how things have sort of occurred. But I also don't look at Vegas as for me, it's a place that's a good time. It's not my scene. And okay. When I go, you know, and I've gone there thinking like, well, you know, it's not for me. I'm not really like a gambler, but maybe there's other fun things to see about it. So when I've gone there for work stuff and you walk around, you're like, well, maybe there's something here. And like every time I'm going like, yeah, this is not my spot. You know?
Okay, I'll agree with you. I've only been to Vegas once, and it was for fun, and not to say the trip was a mistake. The trip was a really fun trip, but being in Vegas proper and on the Strip, definitely not for me.
Right.
The last day of the trip, we ended up renting a car, and we ended up going to Old Vegas, which still has the same things except on a lower scale.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not like $20 hands at blackjack. It's like 50 cent slots and $2 hands, and it's a very like, it's almost like a family vibe. And it's near like the neon graveyard where all the old 60s Vegas signs ended up like being kind of corralled. So that part was fun. The other stuff, again, not for me. I can't imagine what Reno in 1992 must have been like.
Yeah.
And what do they call it, the biggest little city in Nevada,
yeah,
or the biggest little city in America.
Oh, I don't know.
Regardless, so Whoopi is a lounge singer in Reno. She's dating Harvey Keitel's character, who seems to be a gangster. My question is, does he own the casino?
Yeah, the movie sort of like you were mentioning, it takes almost an hour to get to the point, but it does. It still like brushes over a lot of stuff that wasn't like really properly communicated. Like we rushed through that first scene, and to be honest with you, if I watched that first scene again when we for the podcast, and I was thinking like, if you showed me this scene and said like this is the beginning of the movie, not knowing anything else, I would have turned it off. It's so flat. It's not funny. I'm like, what is this? You know, it's so awkward. Like, her rebellion is like, Elvis, you know, I'm misnaming the apostles. And they're like, oh, you're a troublemaker. Like, that's like so lame. And it doesn't set the movie up well for me. But then after that, it fades into, she's a lounge singer. She's in a play. She does like a musical number. So it's showcasing her talent. And then she's presumably shacking up with Harvey Keitel. And the other thing too is like the movie, it does a lot of tap dancing around things.
Yes.
That it should have, needs to say, but that doesn't. So like, we're sort of like getting it to like, okay, he's through the conversation, he's talking to Dolores, Whoopi Goldberg, and saying, yeah, you know, I'm gonna leave my wife, blah blah blah. Mm. So they set up properly that she's his mistress,
right?
And they've just sort of like got together because he's getting dressed, you know. But they don't show like, you know, everyone is properly dressed, but he's the one who's like sort of pulling on a shirt. So it's like even like the idea of like having sex or something is very played off like super super innocently, you know?
Yeah, and it's I think it's also like a lot of stuff like that in the beginning of the movie is. It takes 53 minutes to get to the basically like the crux of the movie, right? Mm-hmm. Like why you're watching this to begin with. But the stuff like that with like their non-sex scene, you know that they're in a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Could they have done more to establish that? Sure. You don't really know what he does. You kind of get the feeling that he's not a very good guy.
Yeah.
Right? They have an argument about him leaving his wife, and he's like, I'm Catholic, I can't get a divorce, I'll be excommunicated from the church.
Right
He's very concerned about this. He leaves, she does her thing with her group, then the same day she gets a package from him that is
what was it? It's purple mink, Dolores, and they make a big deal about it, and I'm like, I don't know my minks. I don't know if purple is, you know, if it's like a legendary drop in Reno or something, like in an RPG where purple is particularly rare. But like, you know, I was like, I feel like, you know, it's like that weird, like, it's got that trashy chic. So it's like, my God, this is amazing. And you're just looking at it from an outsider going like, that's weird. I don't know about any of that. But like, yeah, like
showbiz, baby.
It's right. There's a lot of things where it's sort of like, I'm not saying like before, like when like they had to have had sex or shown them like to establish a relationship, but it's so like inoffensive. It just shows like two people having like an awkward conversation, you know? And then it takes you a while as like if you don't pick that up, you're like, why are they hanging out together? They're not eating, they're not doing whatever. And then you're sort of like, oh, they just had sex and this is the argument about, I can't leave my wife. It's in God's hands. You know, I am not,
right.
You know, and that's like his excuse. And she's obviously like, listen, you know, what it establishes that she wants to be with him, even though he's being like a dirtbag.
Right.
And then the scene after with like the mink where he's like, it shows like his passive sort of like, I'm going to appease her. You know, this is my side piece, like whatever. Here's a purple mink coat. And it's like a hand-me-down purple mink coat. So she's teetering on that. Do I want to, you know, like, is this worth hanging on? And then, like, even when she's like, after that, she's like, well, I'm going to go yell at him.
I'm going to tell him off.
Right. And this is the impetus where she goes. And she's like, even at that point, she's like waffling back and forth. And it takes like the next scene to push her completely over the edge, mainly because her life is on the line.
I think there's a little before like her life getting pushed to the edge and all that. I think there's a little bit to be said about just like that filmmaking ideal. This always was a family movie, right?
Yeah.
So I think the people who made this were probably born in like a little bit of a different time, you know. Mm-hmm. And the lesson that, and this is a Disney movie too. So there's a clear line of saying, if you're a bad kid, you're going to be an adult who makes terrible decisions. You're going to end up with a terrible person. And your life might be on the line because you witness a murder.
Right.
Right? So it's kind of like almost like a subconscious message of like, hey, you don't want to end up where Whoopi Goldberg is. So don't make these bad decisions.
Yeah.
Right? She gets the coat. She goes to tell this guy off. And opens the door into a murder, right? Number one, again, does he own the casino because he's in a private office? Number two, he's only got two guys that work for him, as far as I could tell.
It's like the sloppiest, like, quote-unquote mobsters I've ever seen. Because, right. I kind of figure, like, that's his club, that's his casino. Mm. He has his office. And the thing that I keep going back to is that, so what she walks in on is that he has a driver. Like, those are the two guys that work for him. This other goon is, the third?
He just killed a third of his workforce.
Yeah, he killed a third of his workforce. He's apparently a snitch, and they found out. And so they get him to confess to snitching, and then they're like, all right, take care of him. And they just up and shoot him, like, right in the office. You know, they do the silencer, which had like the golden eye sound effect. I was sitting there watching this going, like, if you wanted to establish like a credible mobster,
right?
Like, they're usually pretty good about not connecting themselves to murder. Yeah, in the sense that, like, they wouldn't off a dude in their office and have it be like the cleanup and the evidence and all this other stuff. They'd be like, take him somewhere else. I have an alibi. I mean, he's still in the room. You know,
he just turns around. He doesn't even turn around. He just says, take care of it.
Yeah.
But are we to infer that because it's Reno, he's a dopey low-level gangster?
I think that was it. Or it's like, I'm sitting there calling this guy out on being like a lousy gangster.
Right.
But I think that's it. Where he's just sort of like, he's so low-level that that's where the comedy is coming from, where it's like all this sloppiness, or he has like these two like oafish goons, and he's like he thinks he's like higher up and more important than he is. I mean, he's like connected because all this other stuff happens, but maybe that's like the level of like mobster we're dealing with. It's sort of like this weird like basement level,
and
you know,
and this is the stuff that like you kind of pay attention to. I feel like the older you get, and I'll speak for myself on this, I don't know how you are, but I feel like the older I get, the more discerning I am with how I spend my time watching a movie.
Sure.
And I mean, like, if I will say this, if I have a kid one day, I will definitely be like, why don't you watch Sister Act? It's harmless.
Yeah.
The jokes are not that great. A kid will laugh at them. Awesome. Great kids movie in a weird way.
Yeah.
Right? Not like... like a small kid, but like a 9-year-old,
right?
You know, or like
if it's on TV.
Nine and 12 watch Sister Act. You know, great.
It's like you're really sort of watching it for like the musical numbers, and all this other stuff is like this weird wallpaper, you know.
I kind of disagree with that.
You think so?
I think so because I think it's not so much the musical numbers.
Yeah,
it's the fact that it's Wacky Nuns doing them.
Yeah, I mean that's sort of the joke here, and it's sort of like that's the trope being played is, it's these nuns are doing something not nun-like. Hee hee hee.
It's the
hook. And there's a lot of things that happen there that, I mean, we'll get to it, but like when we leave with Dolores, who like the way that she gets there is she sees this guy get off, and then she runs away, and she runs straight to the police, and then she talks to a police officer, and he's like her point of contact throughout. Like, what was his name? Lieutenant Eddie something?
I don't remember.
Yeah, it was like Lieutenant Eddie.
It was Radio Raheem.
It was Radio Raheem.
Did the right thing.
Yeah. So she runs to Radio Raheem, which, you know, you should do anyway. Mm-hmm. But you know, the she goes over there, and it's like, all right, we're gonna put you in witness protection. I got a spot.
Yeah.
And then it immediately cuts to the convent. And I'm sitting there just staring at the screen going like, why is this his first and only go-to? You know?
He's been sitting on that convent.
He's like, oh man, I got a good spot. I haven't done witness protection before, but when I do, I'm ready.
It's well, because
like they sort of, they later, and they don't even talk about this now, is like, we've had a hard time keeping our informants alive. You know?
Right.
That would have been useful now.
Right.
To say, not to her, obviously, but like you have like some sort of dialogue with another officer going like, I don't know where to put her. This is all our usual spots have been compromised.
Right.
I need to think of something out of the ordinary. Yeah. I gotta do some out of the box thinking. But she's like, he's like, I'm gonna put you in witness protection. He's like, where am I gonna go? Cut to convent.
They don't even tell you where it is.
No, they don't. First. Yeah.
Right.
It's like this weird, like they do like an establishing shot of like San Francisco, but it's like you know, it's hard to like establish San Francisco if it's not the Golden Gate Bridge for people who are just like not familiar with San Francisco.
Right.
And
right.
I think it's like sort of off in like the top right corner or something. But yeah, and that's like the kickoff.
Mm-hmm.
We're still like trying to fast track it, even though it's in an hour, to get her in the situation where we're putting in the convent. And they sort of established too that like the convent is like hard up on money, and they're gonna like pay to harbor her essentially.
Okay, I feel like there's a cut of this movie that somebody put together where it's just like a real deep action packed 15-minute flick where it opens with her seeing the murder, and then it cuts immediately to her in the habit.
Yeah,
on the lam, and then it goes to the car chase. So are you a Harry Potter guy?
I read the books and I enjoyed the movies. Okay. That's about it. Like
every time I see the actress who plays the headmaster, Mother Superior.
Yeah.
Professor McGonagall.
McGonagall for sure. Maggie Smith.
But I like that. I'm looking at your notes right now, and I agree with the next statement is 100% accurate. She does seem very out of place.
Yeah.
And there's no backstory for her either.
Again, like there are certain things that. You know, I don't know, like, sometimes I think about these things and I feel like maybe I'm being unreasonable in asking certain things.
No.
You know, like, in the sense of, like, what do I want from a movie called Sister Act? Like, do I want, like, deep backstories? Like, no. But at the same time...
You kind of do.
I think Maggie Smith is awesome.
Absolutely.
And she's great for the role.
Mm.
But I don't understand, like...
Reverend Mother.
You know, the Reverend Mother being, like... this super like eloquent and posh British, you know, nun, in charge of this thing. She says she's been there for a while, but it's like, how did you get there? You know, and San Francisco is like an eclectic place, but it still seems a little bit weird. Like I want some sort of line, you know,
yeah.
Because I feel like they go so far out of the way to make the convent seem otherworldly.
Yes.
That they forget that it's actually in San Francisco, the United States.
I'll agree with that sentiment 100%, because when you're inside the convent, it looks like they're in some kind of mystical lair. And I'll also agree with you in the, I don't think you should reflect on yourself and say, am I expecting too much? Because if you break it down, you're like, you know, like your life, if you're Whoopi Goldberg's character, her life choices led her to this moment where she witnessed a murder. And now she has to hide out with these nuns, right? Maggie Smith's character, you're kind of like, well, how did you get here? You know, like what decisions did you make that led you to being a British nun in a very desolate part of San Francisco? And what backs that sentiment up is all the other nuns don't seem like they have their shit together.
Yeah.
So I feel like that's like she's kind of corralling the misfits in a weird way. And, and that's also the other thing that I feel like this movie is at the heart of it, like mostly about, it's misfits, you know, because the nuns are misfits. They don't really know what to do. They haven't been exposed to anything. You have kind of like their dynamic is very interesting because it seems like they just listen to Mother Superior without a Reverend Mother without questioning her. And there's like a little scene. I don't know if you want to talk about this now or later with the biker bar.
Right.
So
let's get to that because I want to say a couple things about the nun, the convents before we get there, because I have a few things to say about that bar. But I get what you're getting at, and I like the idea of them being like the collection of misfits, because you get a lot of the sense, especially from like the mousy nun, or she's just like intimidated and scared of everything, and that place is so much like a sanctuary, not just like it's a sanctuary religiously, but it's like I'm scared of everything outside. You know, I don't understand it, I don't fit in, I need to be, this is the place that makes sense to me,
right?
You know, that's like, and they're like, that's, you know, they're like, that's my calling.
And
it's charming in the sense where even like when she says this to Dolores, because Dolores is at this point like having like, I don't fit in here, blah blah blah, and it warms her to know that like I'm sort of like, they commiserate in the sense of like, yeah, I don't really fit in here either. But the nun is like, I'm a nun and I don't fit in, and this is the only place that this makes sense to me, you know. Before that, like, we sort of established that they're like, okay, we're going to hide you here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, Dame Maggie Smith, you know, isn't she a dame? Probably.
I don't know.
McGonagall goes, listen, I agree to keep you here. You know, this is what my vow to protect people, you know. Well, we're not going to tell any of the other nuns. It's going to be a secret. You're going to be in costume. And I was sitting there going like, why? And they throw a line going, the fewer people who know that you're here, the better. Yeah, that makes sense. These nuns, though, don't talk to anybody outside of the convent.
Right.
And I presume that, you know, they're like, you know, you make them establish that they're like good people who are not like, they don't have any like, you know, like their personalities come out later, but they're for the most part, like pretty much on the level. Like, I didn't look at those going like, I don't know if I could trust these nuns, you know?
Right.
You
know? Right. Yeah. Like the nun thing is very interesting, and I feel like it's not explored a lot because of, you know, like that's not the point of the movie. They're not talking about it. They want to get these nuns singing at some point in this movie.
Sister Mary Lazarus has some loose lips. We better keep her out of this. Like
and also up until like the movie does a good job of reminding you why Whoopi's there because I completely forgot at this point. You know, once she puts the habit on, the murder witness thing, gone from my head.
Yeah.
But the only people who know are
I think he knows.
The head priest.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And the Maggie Smith, Smith's character, right? They're the only ones who know. And they do a good job of reminding you, like, whenever Whoopi does something crazy, it's like, hey, listen, you're here for a reason. Like, you can just stay in your room and shut up. But she says, I'm going to stay. Can I just stay in my room and shut up?
Right.
And for some reason, she doesn't. You know? Is it boredom? Is it, like, restlessness? She can't leave. She's kind of stuck there. And it's not so much a prison, but it's like a wacky situation, right?
The movie starts to conflate the convent tropes with like movie convent tropes with movie prison tropes.
Right.
Like she has, I know they call it a cell and there's like a joke there, but at the same time, they're like, this is lunch and we're going to put you to work. And she's like, I don't have a phone, which is like a very funny, like everyone needs a phone, like that sort of a thing. Well, I would say like, I don't have a TV. Like maybe I can see her watch TV. Like,
right.
There's ways of like setting her up where she's like, I'm just out of the way. But they immediately say like, you have to participate and go by what we're saying, and she sort of, like she goes along with it, but she's complaining about it the whole time. And I think it's kind of weird that like they want to get her, they're trying so hard to put her in a position where it's like she has to be like this fish out of water,
right? You know?
But anyway, we're there. She's joined these order of nuns as what was her nun name, Sister Mary Clarence or something like that.
Yeah, I think so.
So. She's got like a loose backstory. They say you're going to be Sister Mary Clarence and you're going to be, that's who you are. You're from the Reno division of the church.
The progressive nunnery or progressive convent or whatever it is. And then she stumbles on to their choir practice. Mm-hmm. They kind of pull it out of her that she has a history in music. The old battle axe nun says, I knew you're going to take my job for me. And then she ends up making them belt out a couple of notes, and that's how the ball gets really rolling in this movie.
Yeah, like that was the thing where it was really funny because like they're trying to, we're finally at this point where we want to put her in a place. She's clearly a misfit. She's clearly unhappy.
Yeah.
Maggie Smith has put her to work doing like weird things.
Right.
You know, like scrubbing and whatever. But like also like there's like a scene where she's like, go clean the graffiti out. And it's like, no one cleans the graffiti. It's still there. This is the first time someone thought of doing it. It's like, why is she being like, quote unquote, punished? You know, there's like servitude and participation. But another thing where it's like, I feel like she's like being punished. And it's kind of weird. And it's like this weird, what is this thing about Maggie Smith? Like, what is she saying? Why is she putting her to work?
Yeah,
like, is it making her repent for like being like a Vegas lounge person?
Absolutely, I think that again. Like I think like I said before, like that's the Disney kind of thing of like, well, you don't want to be punished, do you? So don't make these weird decisions in your life, you know, especially in the confines of like the overarching religious tone to it, which is like, you know, if you want to get to heaven, you got to do good things.
Mm.
And then I guess the nun took it upon herself, the headmistress took it upon herself to say like, you know what? Regardless of the state you're in, I'm going to add to it.
Right.
You know, if you feel like shit now, I'm going to make you scrub this floor. I'm going to make you do this. What we could have turned around and said, no, I'm just going to go to my room. Is there any way I can give somebody $200 to go buy me a TV?
Right.
I want to watch TV. And I'll sit. And the rest of the movie, the rest of the story could easily have been her closing the door when she heard their bad choir practice and watching TV. You know?
It could have, that could have been another like easier lead in because like they wanted to have like the montage of her like slaving away.
Right.
And like, you know, yeah, she's like, does this place have a library? Can I just like just get out of the way? I'm not part of this. I'm not beholden to it. But, you know, like, yeah. And then that would have been a great thing where she's like, I'm trying to keep quiet. It shows her being restless, you know, like she's a very like energetic person.
Yeah.
Like she's like, I'm going to chill here. But then that would have been her going like, I can't do nothing. I feel like that would have been more believable where she's like, can I do something?
Yeah.
You know? And then she hears the choir thing. She's like, I'll listen or I'll go check it out.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm rewriting the movie now.
No. Like, so let's talk about the biker bar scene. So the biker bar scene happens before the first number.
She doesn't join the choir yet, right?
Right.
Okay.
So it's,
she escapes. That restlessness happens. Right.
So she sneaks out. And then she ends up going to like what I assume was a biker bar, you know, and it's like she's in the bad part of San Francisco. She goes to this bar. Number one, like I was watching this with my wife also, and she was like, why would you go to that bar? Like, why would she escape and then go to like, it seemed like she just went to the first bar that she found dressed like, and she was dressed like a nun.
Right.
She couldn't have like put on like a sweatshirt or like a turtleneck or something and left, you know.
That was another thing that we were saying when we were watching it, is that like she doesn't have any other clothes, and I get that she's supposed to be in the habit all the time, but all the time, because the movie makes out like she sleeps in it,
you know. They should make a sequel called Sister Act 2, Back in the Habit.
Yeah, it's like nuns in pajamas. You know, like and that was the thing that was like a minor thing, but it's like one of those things where, you know, like make it a little bit more believable, like not that like cartoon characters wear like one costume all the time, like nuns have like other clothes to wear, you know, and at least even like if she, you know, like a nightgown or something, okay, you know? Like I feel like nuns sleep in not like fully dressed. The biker bar thing, I stood out to me where I was watching it, and sometimes they made it like look like, oh, these are like biker tough guys and stuff like that. And I'm sitting here going like, I don't think these are biker tough guys. I think this movie is actually slipping in a gay bar and just not calling it a gay bar. Because everyone is like, you know, they don't look like mean, like street, you know, people like that you'd put in a movie to establish it's like a hard place.
They're not Sons of Anarchy.
Right. You know, everyone is like, you know, everyone's like pretty well put together. Like it's not a scummy place at all. And I think what it is was the movie sort of putting in a, you know, the movie, apparently like the church that they filmed in is just like just south of like the Castro district in San Francisco.
Okay.
You know, and I feel like I want to give the movie the credit that they wanted to sneak in a gay bar in this movie in a time where like maybe that would have been like a little bit weird and they didn't want to, you know, like ruffle like feathers and try to, again, be inoffensive. You know, now it's like, we would be like, oh, whatever. But I feel like that's them sort of acknowledging, like, this is part of San Francisco. This is part of the culture here. We can't just, like, wash it over it, you know?
So you go from this scene of, like, they're meeting the community, which was another subplot that the Mother Superior, the headmistress, Professor McGonagall, didn't want them to go out and meet the community. Mm-hmm. So you're kind of getting that spiral of things happening, you know, like the perfect spiral of the misfits working with the misfits. This lady's here for a reason. Is it destiny? You know, like it's kind of like that whole mythical religious equation as well. Yeah. Right. So they finally do their first big song and I enjoyed it. I felt it. In that moment, I forgot about the entire movie, and I dug it.
Are you talking about the first song where, like, they show how bad the choir is, or, like, they're...
The first performance on a Sunday where the street toughs they were dancing with end up coming into the church.
Well, that was cool, because, like, after we... Okay, so let's do a quick rundown of, like, the standout nuns. So there's There's the battle axe that you mentioned, Sister Mary Lazarus. I remember her name because she was awesome.
Right.
Because she's like, yeah, like I feel like she wanted to be a Marine and couldn't enlist, so she became a nun.
Okay.
She's like, yeah, I came from Vancouver. We like walked in the snow. We had like leather feet, and you know, like she was like a real like hard ass about it. She's like leading this choir, and it's really bad. Everyone is caterwauling essentially, and they can't get it together, and everyone's like super polite about it. They're like, oh, you guys are okay.
Yeah.
Mary Clarence comes in, and through her trying to like, I'm from Reno, we did whatever, she's like, oh yeah, I did music. And then the other nuns who had snuck out with her, the other nuns were being like the mousy shy one,
right,
and Kathy and Jimmy, who is the biggest energy of this movie.
Absolutely.
You know, she is a force of nature, like completely bubbly and happy all the time. They're like, oh, yeah, like if you know some music, like, can't help us out. And and then like Sister Mary Lazarus is like, all right, you're here to replace me. Fine, you know, let's see what you can do. She manages to show that she actually has like, you know, it's almost like the movie at the beginning was sort of talking down to her, going, you're a lounge act singer, you're nothing. But then she's like, I know how to arrange a choir and know like how like acoustics and people's their vocal range and how to set this up and notes and blah blah blah.
Yeah.
And now it's like, oh, she's actually like, she's not just like what the movie was calling her, just like some random person like who lived like a miserable lifestyle. She's like, I'm a talented musician, you know. And even so, in the context of the movie, they inflate it. We're like, youths hear them from the streets, and they're like, they come off the streets into the church. You know, they're like music. They're like, oh my God, what is this sound?
I would have liked to hear more music.
Yeah.
To be honest. But that whole thing of bringing people from the community into the church sets up the next bit of the movie where she starts making headlines. And the headmistress is not having it because she's like, you're attracting the like derelict people, this and that. However, the priest in charge says, listen, like, she's doing a good job. I can't wait till you guys go and spearhead this community outreach thing. So then there's a montage of like, they do the big song. They're bringing people into the church. They're quote unquote saving people. And now they're going to go out there and save people. So they start painting over graffiti. They start helping people. They take a look. They're trying to clean up the neighborhood, right?
Yeah.
All because of this one act. And then this is kind of an interesting thing that we both talked about before we started doing this, was she makes local news, and then it ends up becoming some kind of like interstate news where people are watching her on TV and everybody's watching it at the same time. And the cop in Reno is watching it, while Harvey Keitel's wife in Reno is also watching this news from San Francisco. Where they show Whoopi Goldberg's character, where they show her face holding a baby, and she's like cleaning stuff up, and then the cop gets pissed at her, gets there, blah 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 blah. So this kind of like turns into this is like your
You
know, and the stakes get higher because now she's not really living quietly. They may end up knowing where she is,
right?
You know. So you kind of do like a little more back and forth during the montage. You can't have an inner city scene without doing
double dutch. Yeah.
Which is kind of funny. They do the car race. I thought the car stuff was going to come into play later.
Right.
You know, which it really doesn't, but the movie kind of like, it doesn't, this is also probably part of the movie where I stopped paying attention a little bit.
Well, at this point they sort of like almost completed the arc of the church and the nuns, because like this whole thing is like, she turns around, the church is like under, like it's run down, the choir sucks, the headmistress is scared of everything, she keeps everyone inside, and they have Whoopi Goldberg, who like, the choir is great, everyone has confidence, we snuck out, and the people here are actually really nice. You thought that there was a groupie biker bar across the street. It's actually a really nice gay bar. We like we drank soda and we danced to like
music and
stuff, and everyone's cool. And like the you know, she sort of leverages it. She's like, all right, like reach out. That's the way the Monsignor. She's like, it's dangerous. He's like, you're gonna face that danger. You get out there, you're gonna do things. You know?
Right.
It's just like the Judge Dredd. It's like, you nuns will take the long walk into the wasteland and give law to the lawless. But like, they this that does sort of like put her on the map. And it goes back to what you're saying about like, how is everyone watching like local, like San Francisco, like affiliate news in the middle of the day in Reno at the same time? And Harvey Keitel's in like his like weird, like trashy mansion.
Yeah.
You know? And then that's when, you know, Radio Raheem just sort of like fast tracks over to like the same day. It seems like
he shows up the next morning.
Yeah.
It's
only after this that they remember that Reno's far away.
Exactly. Like Reno is over 3 hour drive to, San Francisco.
Sure.
So, you know, like you had, and this is kind of like where it gets interesting. The stakes get a little higher, right? So to cut to the chase, there's a leak in the department. And it was one of the detective's partners, right? Who we got introduced to in the beginning of the movie. He tips off Harvey Keitel, who then sends his thugs to go get Sister Mary.
Right.
Right? He's only got two guys at work for him, which is very odd. Let me look at his name. Eddie Souther, right? Mm-hmm. Lieutenant Souther, played by Bill Nunn. He gets on a plane to get to Reno as fast as possible.
Right.
So this is where your continuity kind of like gets a little screwed up, right? Maybe there was a scene before where he took a long drive and they cut it out of the movie. But here we are, right? And not only that, not only is Sister Mary about to be found out by the bad guys, she still hasn't told the nuns who she really is, right? Two, the cop has to get to her. The good police have to get to her before the bad guys. Three, they threw in a papal concert where the Pope hears about these sisters doing good work in the community and singing their asses off.
I think, right? I think it's really funny that like the Pope, who's like, I'm in the neighborhood, finds out about this and then arranges to go there. And then when the first scene where Bill Nunn shows up, it wasn't to, hey, I saw you on TV, you're compromised, let's get out of here. It's like, I'm going to give you a hard time. You shouldn't have done that. Well, yeah. I'll stay for your performance, though. Like, it's not like, get in the car. Yeah. You got to go now. That's just, that takes a second trip. It takes her location to be leaked for him to finally go, oh, she's really in danger. And that's when he's like, I'm going to take that plane instead of driving.
So you do like a bit of a chase. They end up taking her back to the bad guys end up taking her back to Reno, and then there's like the nuns somehow guilt a helicopter pilot into flying them in a chopper to Reno, and then you have like this very Blues Brothers-esque end to this like the whole ending, very Blues Brothers, the whole movie also very Blues Brothers, where I think they may have like the producers and whoever was involved may have said like, that could have been a selling point. Like, you know, we're going to do this and we're going to do X, Y, and Z with these characters. And somebody may have sat there and gone, oh, like Blues Brothers.
Like yeah,
sure. Like Blues Brothers. I guess so. You know,
I think it's funny because like I said before, like it's now very important how far Reno is from San Francisco. Because like now it's like when she gets compromised for real, he's like, I need to get a plane. And then the goons show up. First of all, like they're setting up for like this papal visit. There is like no security, you know, like I figure like the Vatican or like the feds. Yeah. Still, even though, you know, he's already been shot at this point, you know, PJP took a bullet.
Yeah.
Like he's Pope-mobiled out, you know, they're like, there's precedent. So like the fact that like they snag her and then drive to Reno, and then like the nuns who have to like, they're like, well, we need to get there fast too, 'cause Reno is suddenly really far.
Yeah.
Go to like a helicopter charter and just like aggressively pray at this man till he relents. And he's like, all right, I'll give you a free trip. Like, fine.
Just leave me alone.
And they pack all the nuns in, you know?
Right.
And they go to Vegas where they have like the big confrontation because Harvey Keitel, bad mobster, has to confront and kill people in his own office, you know, again, like incriminating himself, you know?
Maybe he's an agoraphobe.
I don't know.
I think that, like
the movie's all about people like, I can't go outside.
It's exactly. I think that's it. I think that's it on both ends. I think that's it. I think Harvey Keitel can't go outside. I don't think the nuns can go outside. But like it's, everything is such, not that I'm complaining, obviously, like everything is such a neat little package with this movie. And everything is the, for an hour, like movies like what, like an hour and 40 minutes maybe.
Yeah. Something like that.
Everything is timed so perfectly from the thugs taking her back to Reno, to the nuns getting in the chopper, being able to find her at the exact same time in the casino that the cops show up and end up getting Harvey Keitel before he murders her. Right. The in-between part where she pretends to be the nun so that thugs, she pretends to be a real nun so the thugs don't kill her because it would upset their guilt.
You suddenly they're like upset about, they have like that weird wall, like,
right,
they're shooting, you know, guys in the office in the head, like, whatever, they kidnap her, and then when they get to, they had 4 hours to drive to Reno and think about, like, oh, I don't know if I want to kill her, she's dressed like a nun, you know,
right,
and then it takes even longer for them to reconcile, like, all right, take off of this, she doesn't, but like they're like they found a way to get around to the murder that they're okay with as long as she takes off the habit.
Exactly.
You know,
but I think movies also, like, a lot can be said about movie magic, but I do think filmmaking at this point in time was very cookie cutter in the way that it's like everything seems like it's 15 minutes away from the next thing,
right?
You know, like Reno seems like it's 15 minutes away from San Francisco. Mm-hmm. You know, like it's not a 3-hour drive, it's a very much like we have a gun on you and then the next thing they're in a casino, you know, there's no like in between there. We're getting the chopper, we landed, we're here, you know, like, I'm the cop, I gotta find her. So it's all very like, it works. It's very interesting how it works. And I really do think that as far as like a kid's movie, awesome.
Yeah.
Cause I don't think any kids are going to question that continuity and timeline.
No.
You know, for an adult movie, I don't think I would, the next time I watch this movie is probably going to be like 20 years from now.
Well, yeah, I think like the movie is appropriate for children but played towards adults, and I think a lot of it is sort of like, you know, these are, we're nitpicking, but like the point is, it's like you still, like, we're nitpicking because those things sort of do stick out in a sense, because you're like, wait, how do you get here and how do you get there, like, is it really super important, you know, not 100%, but it's nice to, that's sort of what makes a movie feel a little bit more complete and put together, you know, just like the minor things to stitch it together so it's like it feels like not so like loosely like slapdash, you know.
It's also like, I do remember very vividly how this movie was talked about and talked about and talked about when it came out, you know. And 90, and I'm gonna bring the that little list up too, where 1992 was not a slouch when it came to movies.
No,
you know, this movie, while I was watching it, I was thinking to myself, like, where does this fall in terms of like overall gross, like profits, right? Like how much money did this movie make? Because I remember watching TV when I was a kid, and it was Sister Act in the theater.
Yeah.
And then when it came out on VHS, it was Sister Act is finally coming out, blah, blah, blah. And then I really thought, like, we got to see this movie. People are talking about it, you know?
Is it like, was it really, was it popular, but was it, you know, yeah, it was popular, but was it successful kind of thing?
Right. And it was. So the top 10 highest grossing films in 1992 were, number one, Aladdin. Number two, The Bodyguard. Number three, Home Alone 2. That's kind of a no-brainer. Number four, Basic Instinct. Insane that that's like a like, if they made Basic Instinct now, I really don't think it would get, like, right? Can you imagine seeing Basic in the theater?
Yeah, I have to think about that for a little bit. That might end up on our list, depending if we get through everything.
Sure.
We'll put Basic Instinct there and be like, I don't know, this is weird.
We should do that. Lethal Weapon 3, right? Also a no-brainer.
Right.
Batman Returns, no-brainer. That's why it's on the top 10. A Few Good Men, that movie holds up. Very interesting. That's number 7. Number 8, Sister Act, with 231,605,150 million dollars, right? Crazy amount of money. Dracula number 9, Wayne's World number 10, right?
So that was Bram Stoker, the Dracula.
Bram Stoker's Dracula, which I freaking love that movie.
Would you argue that that's probably the last really good Dracula specific movie?
100%.
Yeah. So like the biggest Dracula movie ever, and it's sort of just kind of edged it out, right?
It Sister Act beat Dracula by $15 million.
Wow.
Right? Also, I feel like Dracula's, this is besides the point, I feel like Dracula's just a tough sell, you know, to get people to get out there and go.
Singing Nuns, though.
But Singing Nuns, for some reason, you know, like,
pack that theater.
Yeah, pack that theater. Sister Act number 8. Number 8, right? Crazy time for movies. The early 90s are fascinating when it comes to flicks, right?
And I think that's sort of like why this movie sort of ended up on our lap, because it's that the 90s looking back at certain things that we sort of just, you know, took for granted and took as rote, because like, as you know, took as read basically, because to us, like, these are just what movies are, you know. And that was before we really thought about it and not putting them in context of the things before and certainly the things after, you know, we couldn't do that obviously, but like, or where things were going, but we're like, these are just how movies are. And it's like that formula that you were talking about. And
yeah.
And the idea that like, you can throw out stuff like Singing Nuns as a concept, you know, and now it's like everything has to be, there's so many movies that came out in the 90s that were like, even though this got a sequel, like that, the idea of it being like a standalone movie about a very wacky premise doesn't really get sold now. Everything has to be part of a bigger thing.
Or, okay, so I'm gonna caboose that point a little bit. I'm gonna tag along real quick.
It's a two-man show.
If this movie was made now, I feel like it would have to be a Pixar movie.
Yeah,
and it would. I think it would garner the same success, if not more. If movie didn't exist, all of a sudden 2020 Pixar movie called Sister Act.
Yeah,
I feel like it would do gangbusters at the box office.
Sure, I think an animated like Pixar, hopefully Dreamcast maybe.
Right,
you know, sort of thing. Dreamcast,
DreamWorks.
That's the Sega thing.
Dreamcast.
Yeah, we can get it on Dreamcast. You're absolutely right, but and that's sort of like the realm of those wacky fun family movie premises, that's where they live. It's like all like in the animation world now.
You know?
Like, how are you gonna, like, you could get Harvey Keitel and Whoopi Goldberg and Kathy and Jimmy to do the voices, but you would probably not wrangle them to cast them and do it like old school, like this movie has been, you know?
I think also, like, this movie oddly was made perfect time, perfect place, because Whoopi was still considered like a bad girl of comedy, I guess.
Yeah.
And, you know, she had a lot of success in the theater. She was a household name. People knew who she was. She was Guinan at this point, you know. She was Guinan already.
Yeah.
Right? For quite a few years from Star Trek Next Generation. And I think it's just an interesting casting choice, you know.
Right.
It works perfectly with her in the lead. I think, and Kathy and Jimmy too. I think everything else in the movie is superfluous. If it wasn't Whoopi, I really can't see anybody else like pulling this movie off, number one. And number two, we were in this time of like where I think Hollywood was still very old school, you know? Even Whoopi's delivery in the movie is a combination of like Jackie Mason and a little Billy Crystal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she brought like a, even though she was in Reno and went to San Francisco, she's a New Yorker. And I feel like she brought like a little bit of that vibe to this movie. You know, without even saying anything, I think just her nature as a performer is to have an East Coast kind of attitude to what she works in, you know?
Right. I see that, and it makes sense, especially like the Billy Crystal thing, because at this point, like, I think that what was it, the charity, the comedy charity?
I'm not sure.
I'm blanking on it, but she was
Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee.
That was it. she was part of like that triumvirate. It was like her and Billy Crystal and Robin Williams.
Right.
And they were doing the charity that I can't remember.
No, I know. But, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. But that was like a big thing, you know, and she was a big part of that, you know? And I see that influence, and it's cool that you pointed that out. And, you know, the other things too were we were talking about like how this movie sort of comes together in with the characters, because it's really sort of like a showcase. And if it was made today, let's answer your question first. Who else could carry this movie? Originally, it was supposed to be Bette Midler, but she turned it down.
Would have been a different movie.
It would have been a wildly different movie. Yeah. And the other thing too is that like, making the movie now, what we're talking, I was thinking about it, is that like, you have to do all of it. You can't come in like, they had like the mousy girl who, her whole like shtick was that like, she was very timid, but then she had like this great voice that came out. She had like a singing voice replacement. Someone else like was singing for her.
Right.
You know, but if you made that movie now, you would have to book a singer. The acting would come later. because you need someone, you need like the triple threat, or the at least the double threat, that like, if you're going to carry this movie about singing, you have to be singing, you know? Have to at least, we have to at least make you, if not, we have to make you sing better.
It would be more of a production if this movie, if they used real people, it would be more of a, as opposed to like what we're talking about in the animation, it would be more of a production now. But you never know. In 10 years, they might remake Sister Act and it might be something else completely different. You know, they'll take the, like what they did with the Karate Kid remake, you know, it might be something completely different and people will kind of be open to it. You know, it's a premise that works for a lot of things, you know, Fish Out of Water, The Misfits, kind of fixing your life. Oh, I found a family with these other people who were kind of like rejected by society in a weird way, you know? So it works. The movie works 100%. And there's a reason why it became so popular and made so much money. And I will say it is a beloved movie for me. I'm okay not watching it again. Right. You know, I get it. I laughed a little bit. I chuckled at a lot of stuff. I think my chuckling also came from just like weird things. Like they're wearing winter coats in Reno, you know, this is very oddball stuff. Like what's your final analysis?
I think the talking about it was it was fun to revisit this movie, and I agree with you. It's like, do I really need to watch it again? No, but I'm glad that we did this one more time.
Agree.
You know,
okay.
Because I'm glad to revisit it, and well, because like you know, you have like these like a lot of the things that you know is the case is that you have these movies and you know they're beloved, you know, to people or to yourself, and going back and looking at them going like, all right, well, is it really as good as I remember it? Probably not. But is there also like what about it is so charming to me? You know, what does this mean to me? You know, watching it again, because like I remember, like, even though it's like it's just like a jazzed up choir music, I thought the songs were a lot of fun, you know, and I think that's it. I think it's less like, oh, these are great. I think like, these are fun. You know, I feel like this is like that positivity, that energy is so so like non-cynical, and
it's infectious
and it's just joyful for the sake of being joyful. And while the movie sort of plays around, like even like when Maggie Smith says this to, there was a great line where Maggie Smith says something to I think it was the Whoopi Goldberg, she's like, you and I know what it's like out there, like these young ladies, they think, you know, they believe in the power of good and all that, and she's like, I do too, but like we know what the real world is like, you know. And I love that the movie is sort of like, all right, there's, you can bridge the gap, but here for like this moment, we're just gonna sing a fun song.
It's innocent.
Yeah. And I think that sort of like leads into like, wow, now people are coming in, because it's like, yeah, you know what, like all of that other stuff outside, that's not going on here,
right.
Even the movie itself makes it, a movie about nuns makes very little attachments to itself, that it doesn't talk about religion at all, you know, which I'm fine with. But at the same time, it's like, it's also just sort of like, don't worry about any of this stuff. Just come in here. We have some fun songs. They're old ladies who are having a good time, and that's it. And I think that's the charm that has stuck with me, where like, I'll think about those songs, or like they'll come up in conversations like in the house or whatever, you know, especially like when it's, you know, it's still kind of funny that all these like sweet old ladies have like their different like little moments to shine and when they're singing. And I think that's where I land with the movie. The rest of the movie, it's like, whatever. I don't even remember half of it, but you know, like I didn't remember half of it before watching it, but it's like, oh, these parts stick out and these are the parts that I really like, and that's why I like about this movie.
Okay, fair enough. I see your point. I do enjoy the innocence of the movie. Would I put it on at my age when I can just easily put on Iron Man 2? It's a tough sell, man.
Well, I mean, there's the other thing too, and I thought about this too while I was writing the notes, is that like I have so much more affection for this movie, even though I remember more of the second movie. And I think and I think that this movie, so the other movie, like just the quick sort of attachment about the second movie to this one is that like it basically does the same thing, where like it finds like someone who's quiet and has like a great voice, and then the struggles of this. And the connection that I have more with that movie is sort of like they're like students in like a private school.
Okay.
And they're like younger kids in an inner city, and the focus is on them, not so much as nuns in a weird
Rockin' place. Nuns. Yeah,
and
yeah,
I feel like a lot of my friends sort of remember that movie too, because that's more relatable for where we were in our life. Okay. We were more relate. We can relate to young kids struggling to grow up in a weird place more than nuns trying to figure their, you know, place in San Francisco. You know?
Maybe sister. Maybe we can do Sister Act 2 for season 2.
I don't know. But like the thing is, like, there's nothing really. The thing that stands out about that movie is that, like, it's repeating the stuff from this other movie.
Well, yeah.
You know, like, the story is more relatable, but everything else in that movie sort of takes, like, a backseat to this movie. Like, Lauryn Hill's right. great, and the young, the other young guy who his voice comes out, like, his performances are good. But
yeah.
outside of that, like, even though, like, I relate more to that movie, I don't remember much more about it. I don't. Okay. I mean, I remember, but I don't really, like, have any sort of, like, attachment to it.
I don't remember Sister Act 2. I may have rented it on VHS or seen it on TV, but right. like, it just doesn't stick. This movie sticks out to me more.
It doesn't capture the same magic, you yeah. know. Even though there are admirable things about it, I don't think, like, it doesn't grab you like this one.
So would you recommend it?
I would say yeah. I would say watch it at least once, because I think, like, talking about, like, that being in part of the lexicon now, like, those songs, if you're religious or not, you can still take away something from that. And by take away, I mean, like, you still find some sort of, like, just like a toe tapper. Okay. It's fun. And, you know, I thought it was fun to re-explore this. I'm glad sure. that we did it.
I'm glad too. I would say for anybody watching or listening, if you haven't seen Sister Act, dude, just watch it. Do yourself a favor. Watch it. That's my recommendation. You have to at least see it at least once, right?
Yeah.
Cool, man. You want to take us out?
Anyway, I hope you enjoyed our conversation about Sister Act, not Mortal Kombat, the anti-Mortal Kombat. Although that I kept saying that Kathy Najimy basically does, like, the Sindel, like, finishing move.
She does.
She sings. She's like, ah! And then the walls shatter. Once again, I'm Alex, and this is Rich. Thank you so much for hanging out with us while we ramble about these movies. However you consume your podcast, please give us a subscribe, and we'll catch you next time.
Take care.